Hey, Dorothy.
Hi, Zoe. I'm really happy we're doing this. How are you today?
Oops, sorry.
Oh, okay. There you go.
There we go. I was like, why do I have a green screen on and
I
I have
know. Yeah.
a
Yeah.
sticky?
That was kind of cool. I was just like, she's planning something special.
was like, no, it's just last minute.
Yeah. I'm excited to do this. So thanks so much.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for putting this together. It's really awesome to get to talk about this. And I don't know, this was a really special thing for me to do for you.
Oh, yeah, it's really special, and I just would love to like celebrate the cover with you and Babe, and just like you, and so I can't thank you enough for
Awesome.
everything at Diode, especially the reading this past winter, so.
Yeah, it was really great to see everybody come together, and especially, since the pandemic has been taking place for a really long time.
Oh yeah,
It's
exactly.
yeah, I haven't been able to really celebrate like all of Diode's work or
Yeah.
individually, collectively, like as a press. Like usually I'm used to seeing Patty and Law, in person, and so it's just we text each other like, yay, we're happy
I
publishing day. And
know, I
it's just like,
know.
yeah, so I mean, seeing everyone come together felt really powerful.
Are they
And
in
I miss that.
yeah, are they in Qatar right now?
Yeah, they're still
Oh,
there. they're
I
um
see.
they're
Yeah.
teaching. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So yeah, this is exciting. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. So how we so I have like some questions. So I are we re so I know this is recording right now. Are we can we
Yeah.
like convert this to like an MP4?
I think we can. I know it's saying it's recording up there. I don't know if Zoom said that it was recording for you too. I don't know if you're doing a separate one, but
Yeah.
I don't know how to do that. But I think, yeah, it would transfer to an MP4 or something. And then I think the email you sent said that there's a program. I'm trying to find it now that Otter. I've never heard of that, but so I mean I can try to figure that out. So it's going to be like a text-based interview, like on the website, like the example.
Yeah, that's what I
Okay,
just wanted
good.
to make
Yeah, I
sure.
was like, maybe I should have worn something other than like, I don't know, gray.
No, I think no, like can we just make this a text-based interview? Well, I think we can like convert this, like it can trans maybe Zoom can transcribe and it can just be like a text-based interview. Yeah.
That would also make me much more comfortable because like I'm already
Yeah,
like I'm like I don't
yeah.
know about the way I look, but you look great.
No. I feel the same way. I'm just like, yeah, let's just it's like a Sunday. Like, let's make it a text-based interview. But I'm happy
Yeah.
to see you because I feel like it's so much better when we do an interview and we can like see each other, you know? Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm such a millennial, I guess. Like I can't have a phone conversation, but like I can talk to someone in person or I can text. Like and it'll never make sense to anyone else.
I'm glad that we're doing it like this instead, because if I called you, there'd be all these like pauses and like it's always just like that because you can't see the person.
Yeah,
So
I read lips a lot too. So I mean, that's like really important. So yeah.
So let's okay, so this sounds good. Yeah. Thanks for
Okay.
helping me figure this out. I'm glad we can agree. So I guess I can just go ahead and get started. I've got my
Okay, yeah, like I didn't
questions.
know if you wanted to talk about dive right into the questions or like I don't know. And I'm sorry I'm so late in gathering my stuff. Like I just finished transferring the images to the computer. Like maybe I shouldn't admit
Oh,
that,
no,
but
don't worry
I
about
have
it.
questions. I have questions for you too.
Oh,
Also,
okay,
yeah,
it's gonna
but
be
they're
fun. I
not
guess, yeah.
like I don't know. I hope they don't require a lot of or catch you off guard or anything.
No,
But,
I think I'm excited, and I think that we can just see how the back and forth goes, because I think that the good thing about doing it this way is that like if we were just typing it out, there'd be like also all these like awkward pauses, but we can just see kind of where the conversation goes.
Okay,
And
yeah,
then
sure. Okay.
I'm not sure like how long we should go on for, like when we should cut it off, because the example on the website, I couldn't tell how many minutes that was. But I guess,
right, yeah,
and
did they condense it? Like, would we be allowed to just condense? Like, I also don't want to take too much of your time either.
No, I think we can. I think a reasonable thing, because we do this for Honey sometimes, and I always worry because we always have like such a good time talking to people. But then the longer the interview goes on, the more you have to transcribe and proofread, you know, and so that's not good. So I guess we can see if we start like now, we could do this until like 1:30 to 35. And then if like there needs to be another question based on like how the conversation is going, I guess we can try to think of one that wraps it up.
Okay.
So I think that'll work. Do you think that sounds okay? I think half an hour seems reasonable for like transcription. And then once we have it, I can proofread it. And then we can just see what works best. And I'm sure that like, I mean, Alan's like really chill. So I'm sure that we can like then see what the conversation looks like once it's transcribed and then see what we like. And then we can cut or add depending on like what happens. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
So. Yeah. Yeah. We just want what reflects the press the best. Okay. Awesome. So I'm going to start us off. So I guess we'll start transcribing here. So Zoe, I'm so happy to be having this conversation with you today about Babe. So I love her so much. I always say all my books are like she, her pronouns. So like, I love her so much. I love the cover like a million times infinity. I just remember when I saw it, especially with like the honey dripping and like the candy, it just like made me want to cry. And I just feel like this cover really encapsulates like the meaning behind the book, the ethos of the book, the forms and the content and the joy and sex of the book. And what's beautiful too is that it also captures, you know, kind of the essence of Honey Literary Inc., which is one of my many editorial passions in life. And I just wanted to start out with a general question. And I was wondering if we could talk about the inspiration behind the cover. I know that's really general, definitely, but I think that's a fun place to start.
Okay, well, definitely. And this might be kind of awkward to state, but you are the inspiration for the cover. The book is, and I mean, and also I was looking at your cover ideas, and the honey bear was one of them. Like, I think, I don't know if I can share it, but, or I can just read it. Maybe that would be better. So the first one is, I'm thinking baby blue, magenta, pink, and red for the overall palette and any combo of these. A simple cover with a pink background, a baby blue heart that surrounds the title Babe. Maybe a heart and font can be stylized in a sign type of way. And number two is a honey bear, maybe a honey bear, like one of those honey jars shaped like a bear. And then you go on and you name like other types of food and like these really powerful images. And I fixated on this honey bear because it has this really iconic shape. And, you know, a really rich material, and all of Babe itself and your other work has a lot to do with different types of tastes and like auras. And it's really imbued with, I think, what like a lot of Americans might say is like a brand or something like that. But I mean, for me reading it, I think it's deeper than that, because it's just like intertwined with associations and feelings and experiences that we've had, like when we're like also like ingesting pop culture or something, like, you know, you're eating and you're having these experiences, and you're in maybe, you know, a place like you mentioned a lot in the story, or not the story, in the poems, like eating burgers and shakes and stuff like that. And like I have a lot of experiences that are in like Fuddruckers, and ironically, like that was an American place that I had never been to, but I had a lot of like romantic experiences in Qatar, where I lived before, in Fuddruckers of all places. And it was just, yeah, these like burgers and shakes and like strange things are American in like this weird way, and it connects us, right? So I really enjoyed these like, what's the word I'm searching for, like these really big metaphors for tastes and experiences and stuff like that. And so I worked with the honey bear image for a long time, And oh, actually, I should probably back up. Sorry. So I'm looking at my images and I'm like, where do I need to start? Let me share my stuff. Wait, how do I open it? Hang on. Okay, so I can maybe go over. I'm looking at. Okay, so I grabbed some image references and I started looking at all of these, and it's kind of weird showing you these now because like I've never shared these like even with Addy.
That's so cool. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's so cool. That's a Valentine. It's like such a coincidental timing. Yeah.
It was from this really like kitsch advertisement for obviously General Motors Motorama, and I had this like woman floating around and trying out all these cars and stuff like that, but it took place in Las Vegas. So I was trying to connect, first of all, to the place in Babe. There are like a lot of places in there, but like one of the main like iconic places like this Honey Bear, I'm thinking of other like icons and things like that, is Las Vegas. And so I was thinking of also your fascination with Liberace.
Yeah, this heart really fascinates me too, because this heart in the advertisement, it's a special invitation, but I also think that in poetry, like the poet is essentially giving the reader, the audience, a special invitation in. And I love that like personalization that exudes. I also love the fact that it's a blue heart, which is like less traditionally associated with hearts. So it's got that like unexpected factor. It's not pink or red.
Yeah. And it's I mean, it's really unexpected to see something this genuine in an advertisement. Like, I don't know how it would have been read back in the day, but it was just like kind of jarring. I was like, wow, like put this together. Like, I don't know if they... if what the feeling would have been back then, but I mean, I guess they were going for romance, right?
So I mean, it looks really thoughtful, you know, it looks like sweet, but also like simultaneously sincere. So it's not like, it doesn't cross into sentimentality. It's actually like really sincere. Oh yeah. And here we have Liberace.
Right.
And yeah. Like, so
in contrast to this, like kind of sincerity, you've got this like, over the top showmanship, and I do believe that like in Liberace's sincerity and in the sincerity of the signage and stuff like that, like, but a lot of people take it like, you know, laugh at this queerness, right? That's what it is, like,
it's, yeah.
And I adore it. Like, look at these things, like, and I think. Like, this is Betty Willis. I think that's she did the, I mean, I guess it's graphic design. She was the sign designer for the Welcome to Las Vegas sign.
Oh, you can kind of see it in the background. Oh, yeah.
And she died a couple years ago, but I think that her inspiration must have been Liberace. I mean, how could it not have been? Like, I was looking at his sequins and...
Oh yeah.
That's like, I don't know. It looks like a North Star, but I mean, to me, this is, you know, you're on stage when you arrive in Las Vegas. I've never been to Las Vegas, but that's what I imagine.
Oh, I'll need to show you something. My parents live there. Let's
do a Dio trip. That's so special. Las Vegas.
Wait, let's do a Dio trip to Las Vegas.
Okay.
And then it gets over. Like, let's actually tell Patty and I'll put it on the agenda.
That would be amazing. I love that so much.
Oh my God. I think that this is just so smart, because I mean, like, yeah, you're completely right. Like, I feel that so many people who don't get it, like, they like laugh at this queerness, or they try to like, you know, fetishize it. But there is like, there was a reason why he was like such a big showman. You think about all the outfits he had, like this one is so signature, but he also had all these coats that were like fur and like over the top and all the sequins and the rhinestones and bringing the candelabra onto stage. So absolutely. I find that even today, with all the amazing contemporary architecture going on in Vegas, like, there's this interesting mix of that plus like the kitschiness, but in many odd ways, you know, like Liberace is kind of in all of that, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it because, like, I mean, he took it seriously?
I think he did. I mean, I think he was just, like, incredibly smart. I think it's just this move where, I mean, he was closeted, yes, but it was, like, at least publicly, but it's kind of like this move of, like, oh, how can I trick all these straight people in the audience? Because I remember taking a pop culture class back in my undergrad days at Cornell, which is when this fascination started. And, like, oddly enough, that was also when I was starting to develop my own queerness without being, like, fully aware, right, of, like, my identity or sexuality. But that's what college is for. And I remember how, like, our professor, who's this, like, very, very brilliant scholar, Glenn Ostrler, he's this brilliant scholar of American pop culture and history. He was basically telling us that every single week, like, Liberace would get love notes and, like, marriage proposals from all these women. And that's, like, the funny part. And I just feel like sometimes I subconsciously feel like he did that to also just kind of, like, rub it in people's faces, like, oh, hey, I'm queer. But yet he, you know, it was, like, never stated. And he was adored by, like, all these women. He was adored by all these housewives. And
right?
Yeah, it's funny. Incredible. Yeah, it's incredible. It's over the top. It's, like, unabashed. And it's also just deeply, I guess in that case, it's deeply personal. Yeah.
Yeah, living freely is romantic. And this, I mean, is an incredible form of masculinity to yes. be able to do that. And that is so hot.
I think so, absolutely.
Yeah, right. Whew. Anyway.
Oh, that's great. I love this.
I have to find, maybe I can add another one. Oh my God.
And with the cover, I see, like, the blue. I know that the blue isn't necessarily the focal point with the honey bears, but the blue really, like, makes the honey bear pop out with the magenta honey. So I see that here. I see, like, all of that here too in the book.
Yeah. Where are my other? Sorry, just to. I feel like I lost track of the question. Okay. And I have so many things open. I'm gonna just close these. Right. Okay. So, I wanted to match your, like, excesses and, like, basically the maximalisms of Babe. And I had, like, really high aims with that. And it was, I realized, like, I can't, like, I have to set the stage. I can't, like, you know, mm-hmm. match that, because that's not my style, because I tend to, like, fixate on really small details. And I mean, you can even see that, like, these,
yeah,
the reflections in Babe, mm-hmm. like, that's, yeah, yeah, that's the window reflecting in the honey. And then, like, I zoomed in, like, really closely to change the lines and make them a little bit straighter in places. And then I realized, like, I think that is, like, so much detail in and of itself that it needs more space to just breathe. And then that's where I finished. But before that, I also traveled through all these other, like, maximal ideas. And I wanted to also share some of my, like, really informal design education, very informal, which was, okay.
Well, it doesn't come across as informal, so.
Oh,
it's
thanks.
Gorgeous. It's so gorgeous.
So I used to work at a plant nursery. Ooh, and neat. These ads would come out in the Washington Post, because it was outside of the DC area. And so mm-hmm. we'd get these customers coming in, you know, who still bought the Post. It was, like, you know, these mature women who absolutely loved these, and they needed to use their reading glasses to figure it out. And we would stand at the front counter and try to, like, figure out what they were talking about, because there's really no grid system to these advertisements. It's just mm-hmm. everything everywhere. It's an experience. It's just incredible. And it, like, mm-hmm. thinking mm-hmm. back on that reminded me of Liberace and being over the top. And also just like flowers and queerness. And I used to, like, I'd get bored and I'd stare at these ads too. It's just, so my boss made them, and I think that they're really fun to look at. But a lot of more maybe formally trained graphic designers might have other thoughts. But yeah, so that's where, like, what I think of in terms of maybe like a regional graphic mm-hmm. design aesthetic or something, if there maybe is one for Northern Virginia specifically, mm-hmm. As opposed to maybe like Las Vegas design for Betty Willis or something like that.
Yeah. This is really cool because in this, like, I love the fact that there are like multiple fonts, and I love the fact too, right? That it's like Liberace, right? It's like, it's highly decorative. I feel like this is like this cool cross between, it reminds me a lot of like the advertisements at Trader Joe's. Like, right, those aren't in color, but like, I feel like the fonts are kind of similar, and there's also kind of a bit of like a tiki menu aesthetic going on too. But I sincerely mean this. Like, I really, really, really adore this because at the same time, like, isn't design for the customer or for, in the case of books, like the audience, right? Design is for the audience. And like, this is extremely fun, but also like accessible for the target audience of those women who come in shopping.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, that's so cool.
Let's see what else. We have, I'm trying to go through my odd list. Oh, and I made a list of all the food in Babe. I don't know how exactly accurate it is, but I thought, a great thing to have.
I love that.
Like, it looks, it's just a text edit. Like, it should have been like a word or something
like that. Make me so happy. Oh, wow. Oh, dang. There's that many. I didn't realize there was that many.
But there's I loved it. Yeah, it was just like the food aspect, the taste, the colors of Babe were something that I really wanted to highlight. Okay, and now, like, I wanted to show you all the bears. So sorry.
Oh, neat. Like, I'm so excited. Bear is also so queer, so this is so fitting.
Yeah, actually, I didn't consider that until now because they're like so cute. They're not like, they're not big at all. Mm-hmm. And now I'm just like, maybe I should reconsider.
Oh, that's so pretty. Oh my God. That's so pretty.
So there's,
oh wow,
this bear shape, right? Mm-hmm. And I had all these like weird ideas for, I guess that's not a weird idea, but it's just, I wanted to showcase it that way. And then I started to realize, you know, it's maybe like too iconic. It's too linear. It would have to sit in the middle of the composition, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it didn't, like, I think it would have needed a pyramid shape or something. So when I was trying to work out a cover, I cropped it and I kept fiddling with it, and it just wasn't working. And then I mm-hmm. thought, like, okay, well, I need to get into, you know, the actual mm-hmm. honey of it, the actual medium. And mm-hmm. I have a background in painting. I don't really think that informed it too much because, like, this was like not painting, like, whatsoever. Sorry, can you see that? Like, that's
so you literally painted it. Wow.
yeah so it's, I wanted to capture the actual organic nature of honey, and you can see here, like, it's starting to, I don't know if I zoom in, it was kind of a challenging process. Like, I got all these like fibers stuck in it, it kept running everywhere, so I had to figure out, you know, how I could do it really fast and then also take a picture of it. And then
oh wow, well, thank you so much. Wow.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, so there were two font iterations, and
yeah,
so this one is a serif font, and it's obviously doesn't work, just not working. Mm-hmm. The ligatures are too thin, and it didn't really hold the medium very well. So I needed something mm-hmm. like fat. And I love that I found this intro font. I've been using it elsewhere, but it's really versatile font. But then for this, it worked out perfectly because the medium could expand beyond the limits and still be somewhat legible. And then I took photographs of it in front of a big window just to get all of the textures coming through. Whoops.
Wow.
So Honey has this this really orange look, you know, like in the bottle, it's got this like this really rich color, but then when you spread it out, it just it loses it. And so I needed something to reinforce that. So I figured I'd have to photograph it on a color.
And then
went through all these iterations. Here's yellow. And I ended up using this orange. And
Oh, wow. It's like, I think it's also neat because I know that when we revealed the cover, a lot of people online were saying that like it looks like a lollipop or like candy. And I just feel like the whole process reminds me of like candy making in a sense. And I just like love how sensory it is. I love how sensory your process was now that I get to hear about it.
There were a lot of like, I mean, I guess you would say accidentals, but I mean, like I literally had a lot of accidents. So yeah, it, you could tell it that it's kind of, I don't know, the transparency got a little like scummy. I don't, that's a hair. Okay. That one doesn't have a hair in it.
Yeah. But that, no, but that happens. But honestly, that happens with art, you know, like,
yeah.
It's such like a visceral sensory process that happens. Yeah. Wow. This is so, no, I can't thank you enough, Zoe. Like, oh my God, like, this means so much. Just being, also being able to see the process is just so cool.
Definitely.
Wow.
I talked into your second question, but yeah, you wanted to know about like, I think the layout and how it came to be. So
I was really fascinated what you're saying, because like when you were showing me all the honey bears, I really like adore them. But no, I guess my second question is about the layout, because the final result of Bay, which is stunning, is it's incredibly minimalistic in the best ways, because we have all this space up here, but then you can't ignore anything down here, which is really cool. That's the cover. And I was just like thinking, because when you were showing me all those pictures of the honey bears, which are all adorable, you were also saying, oh, but it's so, I guess it's like, it's so vertical that that doesn't necessarily work as like the main cover. And I feel like that kind of like bleeds into this question too about the minimalism, along with like your whole, I guess, honey making process in creating the cover.
Yeah, it had to have a weight to it in order to utilize the whole space of the cover. Like I mean if we had just gone with you know, a bear, that it still would have been successful in some ways. But it wasn't there for me. It didn't involve all of the space and or the composition or what, like whatever you want to call it. Like I needed it to speak to the background, to the color. And then so I figured I could work in a kind of a drip to look like a bear in the back. So like this is the full spread, and then when the book is closed you can still see the bear, so you know it's still there.
Yeah, I just think it's like so perfect. And I feel like all those like, I guess, like bear versions would be great for like posters or like other products, you know, but for the book itself, this bear, I think it's perfect, from what we see in the back to like how the bear like is on both ends of the cover.
Yeah,
definitely. I think the colors, the color combination too, exudes like maybe the ethos and the spirit of the book.
Right. I wanted it to be tart, something surprising, because honey has this really like deep and sometimes subtle sweetness. And I felt like Babe often gives like a 1-2 punch, or, you know, and then it comes mm-hmm. back for round two or three. And Honey kind of is a like addressing to that, and it doesn't necessarily like, I don't know, I didn't know if it could carry that much energy, so I wanted to to play that up with color.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
and that's thanks to also your color recommendations, like this magenta is very close to this Pantone, I think.
Yes,
like it's just, this one is straight magenta, this one has a little bit of it's either blue or black mixed in with it.
With the
straight.
Yeah, it was like really funny because I was like thinking about like the pinks of the book, you know, because I kind of love like an aesthetic that's also like super feminine or femme, I guess in my case. But after going on the Pantone, I've been like figuring out which exact magenta or magenta is it kind of like light between. I look back and I was like, wait, the one that you just pulled up is actually very, very similar to Barbie's magenta, and I didn't even like realize that.
It really is.
I didn't realize that because I think that I sent it to you one night and then I googled it, because I'm always like interested to see like, I guess, what other brands or products, like what colors they use. And I think that like the one of the Google matches that came up was like Barbie's magenta, and I'm like, oh wait, that actually like really makes sense.
It does.
Yeah
I think you mentioned Barbie also in the book too
at one
point as an embodiment of Babe, and
I think so.
Yeah, I think like that's great. Like I remember also, I mean, I played with Barbie and like this D.
Yeah.
Right. There's something about it that I'm like, wait a minute, where have I seen that? Like that before, and the outline, like, I don't, it was kind of trippy, you know, sometimes when these references like sneak up.
I think so. I mean, I think that these cherries, and I adore this pattern so much. I think that these cherries, like, remind me a lot with like a dress that Barbie wore, but then they also remind me a lot with the wardrobe from Sex and the City, when like back in its like heyday. Like I feel like these cherries remind me a lot of like something that Patricia Field, who was like the stylist for that show or and designer for that show, would gravitate towards. And so it's like something that's like very like unabashedly feminine, but in this very like kitschy type of way.
For which characters? I'm curious. I watched Sex and the City, but like so I want to hear
that. it's an odd cross, actually, I would say, between three of the characters. So the cherries remind me, Charlotte has this cherry necklace, but hers is gold, but she has this cherry necklace. So like one of those cherries looks like part of her necklace. Mm-hmm. But then the pattern itself, though, so it has a little bit of Charlotte in it, but of course, like, the way that she dresses is very, like, preppy and conservative, so it can't be, like, quite her at the same time, but then it also kind of looks like the outfit Charlotte wore to the Playboy Mansion, but this is a lot sexier. It's a sexier print of that, but then where the actual, like, ethos of this lies would be a cross between, like, Carrie and Samantha, because Carrie would be wearing something like this because I feel like that's one of her signature colors. I feel like the pink is kind of her signature color, and later on like that white kind of is after she gets married. But it would also be Samantha too, because Samantha has this great sweater that has all these bananas on it, and like it's not exactly the same thing, but you know, like the connotation is like, you know, the connotation is kind of similar.
But she would totally have bananas.
She would have bananas, but like I feel like both of them are like highly stylistic and kitschy, and like when I say kitschy, I mean in like in this really positive way, because I think that kitschiness has this level of high awareness in it. So I think that a lot of people who, for instance, don't understand the word kitschy, they can't tell the difference between kitsch and middle brow or low brow. But kitsch has a certain awareness in it that is actually really smart and actually takes it back to a very sophisticated concept.
definitely.
Yeah. So yeah, it was just like really funny seeing these like cherries, because I'm just like, oh, I feel all these like references. And earlier on when you were talking about, you know, like getting burgers or like going to a diner, like a fast food chain, that really warmed my heart, because something that I think about a lot is like the meaning of American popular culture to kids of immigrants. And a lot of Babe is kind of this like child of immigrant story. And that always runs through all my work. But I think that there's this like, there's this deep understanding that a lot of kids of immigrants have with how they grasp American popular culture. And oftentimes, you know, I feel like these kids of immigrants, they point, especially as they get older, they point out like problematic things within American popular culture, but yet there is this kind of like interesting sentimentality and memory that they hold on to, because it's basically this idea of like, oh, my parents worked really hard so I could have like access to all these things. So let me rewrite this story. Yeah, so that meant a lot to me. Thank you.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, let's see. Okay, something I that was really important to me when we were talking about the creation of Babe, Zoe, was I believe one day we talked a bit about accessibility, because you know, in those like stages when we were like finalizing the book, we're like looking at fonts. I remember you were telling me, oh, this font is like accessible. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about that. Accessibility is something that I'm continuously learning, especially with like heading a lit mag.
Definitely. So I can't really remember exactly what I said in the email, but there are fonts that are more readable or legible as in the body of a text. And others are more suitable for titles or signage, right? And then there are texts or fonts that are easier to read for people with dyslexia. And then there's another aspect of accessibility where, you know, you can just, you know, if you'd like to read an audiobook, that's for some people way more accessible than, you know, holding a book in your hands. Like I have a couple of dyslexic people in my family and they're like totally into ebooks. And so we've talked about how, you know, how many books we read, and it's, you know, they've been listening to them, and it's, you know, I wonder if I even need to, you know, change the way I like talk about, you know, reading or something like that, or
yeah,
like if we can like think about reading in terms of also listening. And like, I don't know, let's see, I have a lot of like gripes with just accessibility in terms of through like material culture, like ebooks, like people like say, or maybe rely on ebooks as like the cure for like just regular texts, as if that's going to solve like a lot of issues. But it's, ebooks are like a proprietary software. And then you're designing for, you know, a system that's mostly owned by like Jeff Bezos. And then, like it doesn't break down as many barriers as like people think it should.
Exactly.
But and like another aspect of like accessibility within literature in general is just like zines and like DIY culture, chat books are awesome. And like that, well, within chaps, within zines, I've seen a lot of people explore things that they haven't, or maybe wouldn't really be able to think about or share in like mainstream venues and stuff like that. So like mainstream publishing, especially. And yeah, I guess you would call that also self-publishing. I have some good examples. I think like I don't know if this exactly answers your question, but like I was really
oh no, it does.
We're talking about like accessibility because I was like, well, that's like definitely zines, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I'd love to see what you have.
I have just like a small pamphlet of Ursula K. Le Guin's The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but it begins with a quote that says, I want, when asked about what she wanted to see happen to the books after death, the quote says, I want them available. I want cheap paper editions of them. I want them to be continuously downloaded in 40 different languages. I want them to be read. I want them to be argued about. I want people to cry over them. I want unreadable dissertations written about them. I want people to get angry with them. I want people to love them. And I thought that was like this really great anti-capitalist sentiment.
I love that so much. I love that so much. It's I think that like talking about accessibility and like creating texts and like creating like selecting the right font is just like another reason like why I just love working with the entire Diode family, and it's been such a pleasure working with you, Zoe. And I think that's something else that's like really important kind of within this conversation is also, well, it's accessibility, it's also like readership and bringing in more readers and making sure that everything that is created is accessible to those readers on multiple levels. But I also think that this goes back to these questions of like community, and I thought that within this like interview it would be nice for us to like celebrate like all the great work that Diode is doing and like all the amazing Diode authors, and of course all the work that you do, Zoe, along with Patty and Law, who are wonderful. And I thought that maybe we could talk a little bit about some fun upcoming projects that Diode is up to, or what you're excited about with the press.
Oh, definitely. Well, Patty is always like first and foremost in my mind. Everything that I've been able to do that the press is doing and has done has begun with her energy and the love that she has for all of these books, the vision she has for Diode. Her editorial example is one that I try to live by every day. And, you know, Diode or just my experience of poetry in general would not be the same without Patty. And so, and you know, like all the authors are so awesome. There are so many authors with different backgrounds, and, you know, to touch back on your question about accessibility, I also was thinking of people who come to Diode with like a multilingual background as well. And,
absolutely,
you know, they have like poems and that are also multilingual, and it's really awesome to be able to find a typeface that caters to both languages. It's really important for a voice to come through as one author's voice, you know.
Absolutely,
right?
And absolutely. And so,
I think in a couple books, you know, whether it's like Arabic or English or like Korean and English, the typefaces should mirror each other in some way. Like the Hangul shouldn't assimilate into like an English style or like you know the Roman aesthetic. Like we can find like a typeface that's both, and like that was actually kind of a challenging accessibility challenge that I recently like had with a book, and there aren't a lot of like typefaces out there that can accomplish that.
Yeah. I know that's I feel like that's such a major challenge, and it also like says a lot, and that's why I just really value all the work that you do, because like absolutely I think something that like really irritates me was this like is this old standard that some people unfortunately still have, that if in a poem or a short story or an essay you have word or phrases or sentences in a language other than English, people are like, oh, those should be italicized. And it's like, no, you're basically othering a language. It's one thing if the word not in English is italicized because the character, let's say, is emphasizing that word or shouting that word, you know, but if it's just like plain spoken, it should be in the same font or within the same realm. And I think that does say a lot about how maybe why Diode, one of the many reasons why Diode is so great, is because we have these certain design challenges, but how do we like go around that and create something that is authentic and is respectful and it honors like all the cultures and identities that are being set forth, and along with the readership too.
Definitely. You've really touched on like a huge design conversation or a series of conversations that have been happening. Like there's one of my like design textbooks talks about how footnotes have, you know, sort of become a thing of the past. Not really, but like footnotes themselves call back to this time where, you know, people installed like servant staircases like in the house, like to divide foot traffic between classes, between races, like within the same household. And part of the challenge, I think, also in eliminating these barriers also falls on the writer too. Like, why would you want to include a footnote as opposed to just putting everything in the text itself? And why create an hierarchy? Let me just pretend I said that right.
But that metaphor, I never knew that until today. Wow, so that is an extremely strong metaphor, because it is like a hierarchy between the main text and then like the footnote. Wow.
Yeah.
That's margin, such a good point.
Marginalia, all of that. Yeah, it's like people think, you know, like categories can be a good way to, I don't know, instruct, or like, that's kind of what it comes down to. It's this weird sort of, it feels like conversion therapy or something, like when you're reading a book that's like really heavy on the glossary, and it's just like, or like a note section you have to keep flipping around. It's like, it feels like an indoctrination sometimes. At least when I'm reading like a really old book that uses like a lot of like footnotes or something, or
it's almost like too encyclopedic in a way. And then like having to go, I guess for the reader, having to like go back and forth of, I'm absorbing this part of the text, but then I have to go back, or I have to look down, you know, or next to it to be like, okay, here. But then it's like, why isn't all that concept within the main text? I guess you're right, because it also doesn't make for the most pleasurable, or in many cases, like accessible experience for the audience.
Yeah, wow.
I was also wondering, I'm learning so much today, so I always treasure our time together. So I'm wondering, so as a designer, I love to ask this question to like designers and artists. If we were doing like a color association, what are your top three favorite Pantone colors? And then also we were doing like a font association, like what is one of your favorite fonts?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I want to start with the font first, because I have to type it out. And I wanted to see if it actually, there was Baskerville in here. And there isn't. So I'll have to do that in the background. But so it is Baskerville. That is my favorite font for Babe. As you know, right? Because it's
absolutely.
Because I had to see the word queer written with the Baskerville Q.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
And I'm trying to get it down. Right, there it is. Okay. So I took this graphic design class a really long time ago. It was like graphic design for illustrators. This was before I changed my major in undergrad. And my professor, Robert McGank, he really changed my mind about design. Not to get all like sentimental, but he said like the most beautiful typeface is Baskerville. And like that always stuck with me, and because he said it for the Q. And I kept thinking about that Q literally for the rest of my life. And no, I mean, like, I agree, because like I've ever since like he said that in class, that's also the time, as you said before, like you're having these queer experiences in college, yeah. or you're becoming you in a way where you're starting to see yourself, to mirror yourself, you know? And I didn't become the Q, but like, I could see the Q.
Yeah.
I think, take that out of the interview. That was so lame, but like.
That was so good. No, that
no.
Was so good.
But like that Q is so gay. Like, I'm sorry, my kid's in the other room. He's going to come in like wondering what I'm yelling about, but yeah, I'm yelling about a Q. So it's like, it's just such like, I don't know. If there's a queer typeface, this is definitely it. And it's also like really classic. It's pretty readable. Like, I think in terms of in general, maybe Garamond fits a little bit better on the page. But that's another conversation, because this is it's so suitable for Babe, especially.
It's incredibly suitable. And I love the fact that you were pointing our attention to the Q. The Q is so perfect. The Q is so queer. It's beautiful. And I think that Baskerville is also like super clean. And I understand that. I know we talk, it's so funny because writers talk about this all the time, you know, how they love putting their poems in Garamond, you know, but sometimes I'm just like, and I have a tendency to do that when I'm typing up my lesson plans, because then they look more readable to my eye and then it becomes more pleasurable. But I don't know, Garamond is sometimes like a little overrated.
And as a lot of like sort of default fonts go, it tends to have that vibe. Like, people are so used to seeing it. And there are like a lot of accessible fonts out there that aren't also the default. It just, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, what can you do? If Garamond makes people happy, it makes people happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes like you just have to like go with what like the people want. Not to get all snobby, but like that's not what I meant.
I know, but this makes me so happy just seeing that cue today. It was just such a highlight of today. So thank you. And let's see. I have one final question for you. And this is also another big general question, but I want to talk a bit more about unity. And I know that we've seen so many instances of unity today, from being able to capture your amazing process to seeing like the whole process of creating the Honey Words of Babe, to thinking about the placement of the honey bears in unity with the cover, with the fonts, and now with the unity of the fonts that are being used. I'm wondering, as a designer, how would you like succinctly describe the ways in which the cover enhances the story of the book?
I think it relates a lot to tone. I don't know. It's strange. Like this is kind of, my thoughts kind of come with a question. Like, when you're writing poetry, do you see an image, or do the words roll off your tongue? Like how do they get there? You know? And so since I'm more visual, at least in my approach, I tend to summarize things in terms of visuals. And so that's where like I think visual metaphor comes from for me. Mm-hmm. is like an aftertaste almost. Like it's kind of weird, but like I want to convey something that reminds me of the work, like as a shorthand, right?
Absolutely.
And so like when I see covers out there, like the ones that stick out to me that like I associate a lot of myself with, or with a narrative with, it's something that is already associative, right? Like it's in dialogue with something in my subconscious, right? And I'm aware that's also like a very biased read, right? Like I don't want to exclude myself from, or mm-hmm. or other people from like, or stories, I mean, from my experience, right? But I was just also thinking about like what covers recently that I've seen gave me like that, and off the top of my head, like I was also remembering, oh yeah, sorry, I have notes here, but like Randall Mann's A Better Life.
Yeah.
Is really awesome. Good. I have that here.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I love Randall.
It's really well designed. So like these portraits on the front are from Blue Boy magazine, and it's the artist is Pacifico Solano.
Yeah.
And so when you see something like this organized in this grid structure, you're already calling out like newspapers and, you know, tabloids and these structures that already exist. And like before I saw it, I was like, that's kind of like a centerfold, like magazine. And
yeah.
But the design structure also, like inside, every poem is centered on the page. Just the way a classified ad would be if you excerpted it from, you know, the publication, it would be framed in that way. And it really carries forward this visual metaphor in a way that really plays with the text. Where else have I seen that? Ocean Vuong's On Earth Were Briefly Gorgeous, and Garth Greenwell's Cleanness. Those cover images, I can't remember the artist off the top of my head, but like whenever I see figures in black and white, it just reminds me of Dorothy Lange, and her survey of like hardship and feelings and grief, and all of those feelings are carried through those images and also through those works.
Yeah.
And so like when I see a cover like that, I feel like I'm already connected to the story. So
absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to do with Babe.
No, it makes total sense, because we're talking about like the full on unity of it all, and then how like the design elements, these like visuals, these snippets of images that we see, they kind of like bring forth, in this case, the poetry more, because I would always argue that I think the strongest poetry always goes back to the image, and the image doesn't have to be like this literal thing, though many times like beautiful poetry has these literal images that can read, such as like billboards or classifieds or something that's just simply very sharp in our minds.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I had a final, like, I think we have a little bit of time, but
yeah.
I wanted to know more about your associations with color. There was this one really excellent poem that Diode published, and I don't know, I didn't want to like spring it on you because it's a triggering poem.
It's fine. Yeah.
That like, yeah, and so trigger warning if this is in the text, but like which one is it? The Five Sonnets for Red Lips, Goodbye Jay.
Yeah,
I love, like, the whole poem is like presents this color over and over again, but it's like the poem creates a different experience of the color in a way that changes the aura of it. I don't know of any other way of describing it. Like it's something beyond taste even. Yeah, so like it was really surprising for me to read through that, and like especially with the final line or lines, because red is the color of Chinese good fortune, and I'm telling you goodbye forever, Jay, red, because stop. Like it didn't change the color in a way. Like you could be looking at the color forever, but like hearing these lines changes your perception of the color, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. So red is like off, like a big color for, like, from my childhood and also from my life now. So when I grew up in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and so we lived a very, like, nice, like, middle-class life, but obviously Allentown, Pennsylvania is also, like, a very, like, white town. There's not a whole lot of people of color, at least when I was growing up. And so for Chinese New Year or for like special occasions, my parents and I would like drive to Chinatown either in Philadelphia or in New York. And so when I was a lot younger, whenever we would go to New York, it would be for a big family Chinese New Year celebration. And unfortunately, we're kind of strained with my father's side of the family. So, you know, like but my mother's side of the family is in Hong Kong. But either way, you know, regardless of like familial history, like I have a lot of fond memories of going to Chinatown as a kid. And it's like really strange because it's one of those things where, like, as a kid, I was just like, okay, we're gonna do this. And I didn't really have a reaction, but as an adult looking back, it's something that I really treasure. And I just remember from a super young age, you know, the color associations of red with Chinese culture, you know, and like how I remember going to like weddings in Chinatown and how the bride would, even if the bride had, let's say, like a Western dress, it would be white, but then she'd be sure to change into like a red dress that was like Chinese style, Eastern style for the dinner, because like that's just a big part that culture plays in our lives, you know. I'm very proud to be Chinese, and I think I'm very lucky in the sense that when I was young, I was exposed to all these people who were not only Chinese, but also just very proud of their heritage. And in many ways, you know, like with this goodbye Jay poem, The Five Sonnets, I think that the final line in that moment, I feel red. And then before that, we have like red, the color of Chinese strength and beauty. In that moment, I feel red. Oh, that moment. It's this speaker like reclaiming her power. And it's like the speaker isn't just necessarily reclaiming her power in the sense of, let's say, her body, but also in the sense that, she was totally fetishized by this man. And it's also this way of seeing, you know, like we often associate red with anger. We often associate red with lust. You know, we often associate red with sex. We often associate red with blood or injury or harm. But she, that final two lines, especially in that stanza, that sauna, she's basically saying, no, but red is also this color of my culture. And so, if anything, even if I feel that I was harmed and I was harmed, I can reclaim all the power through my culture. And we think back to, you know, like the long history of Chinese culture. And in her case, you know, like the long history of being a Chinese woman, being a Chinese femme. And that's when this speaker starts to regain her power, because red is the color of Chinese good fortune. And it's like this kind of symbol where it's like, even though something really horrific happened, this violation happened, her culture will always be there for her and her ancestors, and her family will always be there for her. And they may not necessarily know everything that has gone in her life, because obviously this is a very like private moment, but there is just so much power in that.
Yeah,
Yeah. Thanks for
it's
asking that.
and you're it, yeah, it's just incredible. It's been
Thank
incredible.
you.
And my first thought in response is like associations. When I was reading that, I was thinking of where else have I seen this in art? And I have a zine, and then I was also thinking about movies and Kozlowski's Three Colors series. The Three Colors Blue reminded me a lot of that poem, because the main character traverses so much trauma. But the film conveys her triumph through sound mostly, even though it's an exploration of color. And so I thought, like, wow, like Dorothy did like the opposite. She's like working with, you know, the sound of the words, but it's changing this color, and it just like it grows, the color grows so vibrant. And so this is the zine I was thinking about, like in response to that poem. The artist is Brandon Dean, and it's called Southern Exposure. So he takes
Oh, so it's
like
so neat.
so it's, first of all, it's very queer, but he takes the Confederate flag and mm-hmm. projects it on his subjects.
Yeah, yeah.
Who are all gay men from the South.
Yeah.
And then he redesigns the flag.
Oh, wow.
To take ownership of it. He's a Black man from the South. I think he mm-hmm. works out of Pittsburgh. Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. That's really neat.
Yeah, it's just this, like, really amazing way to reclaim, or not, maybe not even reclaim, but assert that this has always been mine for me, if I want it, you know? Yeah, it's just this really, I don't know, this admirable poem, so.
Thank you so much. Oh, wow. This was so amazing. So thanks so much for your time today, Zoe.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Cool. Sorry, I'm awkward. Like, is there anything else to... I have more questions if you want to go on. Oh, it's 3:05 though, so... Yeah.
I think I think that it'd be fun if you have more questions. Oh, sorry, I didn't realize, but yeah.
I don't want to like drag it out either too, though. I feel bad.
No, I think that this is a really like productive conversation. So I think that like another question could totally work.
I'm curious, like you said, like you refer to Babe, as she, her, and your works as you give them and I was also like, before I knew that, I was playing with the idea of like multiples in my head of like relating to Babe, and I was wondering if, like, especially thinking of like Norman Duby's words mm-hmm. about Babe, I was imagining Babe as like a chorus of, you know, like Doreen and Esther and all of like Sylvia's creations, and like I wonder if Babe has these figures, like are they like a multitude of voices? Do we sometimes refer to the book as they them, or mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. like who is Babe, where is she or they?
Yeah, I think, and that's a really amazing question. Thanks so much. So I think that I feel very lucky that I think I'm at this point in my career where I can kind of trace, you know, like my work, you know, having multiple books, I'm able to like kind of trace the trajectory of this work. And I don't know, this is like such like a funny little association I just thought of, but like whenever I go to like Sephora or Ulta, I look at like the Buxom lip glosses and lipsticks and how they're all named after like different women and femmes. And like the packaging is also very cool. It's like very like Babe-like because each of the colors, the shades, I should say, is like named after some sort of like feminine name. And in terms of Babe within the trajectory of my work, I think about how my first collection, Attack of the 50-Foot Centerfold, that was a result because when back in college, I was actually asked to pose for, if I would pose for one of those girly calendars. And I said no, and I don't necessarily like regret it, but it's because like I knew, you know, like at the time that I would be going to grad school and I could possibly have a career in like academia. So that was something like at the time I said no to. But that was kind of where a lot of this like fascination with like sex and sex culture and maybe even like, I guess, averting it all. Because I grew up in this time, I grew up in the 90s. And I always like tell people, especially people who are younger than me, I always tell them, you know, the 90s was a very, very like sexed up time. I think about how right now on Hulu, they have that show Pam and Tommy, which at first I was excited to watch, but I actually refused to watch it now because that was actually created without Pamela Anderson's consent. Oh. But then, yeah, and it's really horrific. And I think back to like my childhood and how, you know, like blonde women such as Pamela Anderson were kind of like this epitome of like sex and like what it's like to be a woman. But at the same time, as much as like I value certain parts of my childhood and maybe even to an extent like certain exposures to popular culture, I think about how in many ways younger millennials, Gen Z, are really lucky because I think that we young people today, are really opening up these conversations about beauty. And young people today are also obviously opening up these really big conversations about race, LGBTQ identity, and many other important conversations regarding one's identity, presentation, fashion, sexuality. And I think that within that trajectory, as I keep trying to like find myself at the time when Babe was created, because some of these poems are more recent, but some of these poems happened between the time when I finished grad school to the time when I moved for this job here in Wisconsin. I was basically kind of like going through the motions of like some trauma coming out of like a very bad relationship, i.e. the Goodbye Jay poem and some of the other poems in the book. And I think that at the start of creating Babe, though the poems are kind of scattered based on the narrative that they create, Babe is like very she, her, but I do really think that many parts of Babe are extremely, extremely, extremely they, them. And I would say that even the opening poem, even though the term girl and lucky girl is used, or how the term leading lady is used, I think that there is this big association though, because growing up, even before I knew I was queer, I knew I was a really lonely kid growing up in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And I was a nerdy kid. I was very ambitious from a young age because I wanted to get out of that town. And so I wanted to make sure that I could like ensure a good future for myself. And I'm lucky because, you know, like my parents worked very, very hard, you know, and I can't thank them enough. But I think about being this queer kid, and I used to watch all these like old Hollywood films. And yes, many parts of old Hollywood films, I cannot say enough, are extremely problematic. Yeah. But I will also say this, you can kind of hold both things. You can also say, though, there is kind of this like artistry to old Hollywood films that is completely like lost today. And I think that, of course, queerness doesn't exist as a monolith, neither does like the experience of a queer POC in America. Those don't exist as monoliths. But I would like to argue, though, that people of those and multiple identities probably find something in film that makes them cry, that makes them connect to, because all those films are examples of huge showmanship and artistry. And in many senses of the word, being able to conquer the world. You think about MGM musicals, you think about icons like Judy Garland and what she means to, let's say, the queer community, and how these very powerful women in film who are able, unlike today, who are able to sing and dance and act, no offense to actors today, but it's that back then they had all these high requirements of actors.
They were showmen. Yeah,
they were such showmen. And I think that that's kind of where the beauty of it comes in. Where, again, looking back now, I can say, yes, there are so many things wrong with these films, given the context, who makes them, who was excluded from these films. There's also films that I can't watch because they make me cringe because of the sheer like racism involved. Like, I can't watch Breakfast at Tiffany's at all. But I do think, though, if we're looking at like the other part of that art, that showmanship is really a lot of this queer power.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Okay. If you'd like to answer one more question.
Yeah, let's do it.
I'm curious about your like visual and language tastes over time, specifically in how you're writing and how you're evolving your style through writing. Can you just talk about that evolution specifically with regard to the craft?
Oh, yeah, I love that. So this is actually a really beautiful serendipitous moment because this past week I started to explain and teach the sonnet to my advanced poetry workshop. And I think that like talking about the sonnet is kind of the root of that. It's really interesting because what happened in that class, and these are all very valid questions from students. Some of my students, I send them home with like more homework, but some of my students asked me, okay, so besides the fact that a sonnet is 14 lines and besides the fact that there's iambic pentameter, how do I know it's a sonnet? And then conversely, some students are also like, oh, but I've read sonnets in my spare time that are 15 or 16 lines and the poet is calling it a sonnet. Like, how do you know that? And there were a couple really brilliant answers, like some students who have been picking up on the sonnet a bit more so far, and they're all going to get there, said something like, oh, the sonnet is like an essence, or the sonnet is like a feeling, or the sonnet is kind of like commemorating. And I believe in that. I think that the sonnet itself is a feeling. I like to say that the sonnet is this like amuse-bouche or like appetizer of poetry. And I think that oftentimes, though of course every poet and writer has their own journey formally or content-wise, I don't foresee a time when I will never not go back to the sonnet. I think that whenever I have trouble writing something, everything at least stems back to those, like, that kind of loose-ish 10-syllable count, because that's, like, how we speak. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, poetry has this audience, and we need to talk directly to the audience. So why can't the writer, and thus the speaker, actually treat the audience as, like, a close friend? So if you were talking on the phone with your close friend, wouldn't you say 10 syllables and then naturally pause and then break? And so that's kind of part of that evolution. And I think another part of that evolution is continuously refining, like, how I look at the sonnet. I know to many, the sonnet seems to be so minuscule, like, microscopic, but it really kind of like honed, for me, it really hones in that craft. Even now, as I keep working on my next two collections, obviously I don't only write sonnets. I'm writing these prose poems now that I'm pretty fond of, but I would actually argue that though these poems are, yes, they are distinctly prose poems, they are not sonnets. I think that I take many of my sonnet training into creating these prose poems, in the sense that I look at these prose poems as extremely delicate. I would say that I'm trying hard to keep up my very natural rhythms in this creation as well. Okay. Yeah.
Really interesting.
Thank you. Awesome. I love these questions. Yeah, they really touch me.
I could go on, but I mean, I don't also want to...
Yeah, why not? Like, yeah, let's go on. I think that, like, because okay. It's like an online pub, we can definitely like put in more questions.
I also wanted to know when you first started to incorporate food.
Yeah.
As references. I can't remember if I've already asked that, because I know we touched on this several times, so sorry.
No, I'm happy to talk about food. Okay. Go ahead. What are you going to say?
I was just going to say, like, that one poem we were talking about, there's this one line that says, and I'll need a cherry Coke over my breast soon. I think it's from that same poem.
Yeah.
I love that image that it creates, because I can see a bent wrist and the beading condensation on the glass. And I mean, of course there's a straw, but that's just in my mind. So
it's probably like a whirly straw, like,
right,
or like one of those like Mickey Mouse ones you get at Disneyland. So I love that, because I was thinking about this the other day, like, no joke, I was actually thinking about this. So like, so there's like Coca-Cola, and then there's like Diet Coke, and there's Coke Zero, but then we have like Cherry Coke, and we have like Vanilla Coke, and now we have like Orange Coke, right? And I feel like the Coke that someone chooses is essentially the essence of their personality.
Right, yeah.
I don't know if any of this is like making sense, but I feel like the Coke that you choose is like the essence, and then within the essence of Babe, as was captured in like your in your designs and like the photo inspiration, it's like totally like a cherry Coke, because it is like a pun, like there's a lot of like sexual connotations of that. Mm-hmm. But then we can also say that I don't know, a cherry is a pretty like aesthetically pleasing fruit. It's a pretty like agreeable, likable, crowd pleaser flavor. So I think that that's like highly fitting. Going back to food, so there's all kinds of food in Babe, and I just like adore the fact that you like listed all of them. So there's a lot of different types of food. I think that food that I will always go back to is how, and this is also another really beautiful coincidence, because this coming week in class, I'm actually teaching this essay about food written by this brilliant Asian American scholar. And I think about how when I was growing up, so I was born in the United States, but then we moved back to Hong Kong for about a year. And then we moved back to the States just because my dad is just a really generous person. He just thought that living in the States would be better for me and my brother, though he was making so, so much more money in Hong Kong. So that's sacrifice right there. But I remember these like early experiences I had as a kid, because most of the food that I would eat growing up would be like Chinese food, you know, or some sort of like Asian food. Definitely very, very different than like a standard like white American diet. So I think that that's something people don't always like think about so much, because they think about, oh, when I travel, I want to try out the food. But the thing is, when you're like moving between countries, you are actually like switching your palates as well. Yeah. I would say, even if you because you think about how diverse Asia is, or you think about how diverse Europe is, even like traveling between countries there is such like a vast difference in the foods, even if they have certain like intersections of culture. And I remember being this kid, we were like flying back to America, and I had like no clue what was going on, because as a kid, you just like kind of process everything in your own way. I remember the flight attendant gave me this tray of like, they had a cheeseburger and like gummy bears. I remember like crying when I got the cheeseburgers. I didn't know how to eat it. Like, I know that sounds like very strange, but I just didn't know how to like eat it, because it's like this like new experience for me. And obviously, okay, we know now, you know, like I love burgers, but like that's a very like typical like American casual dining dish, right? And I remember when I started like elementary school in America, I would always be like really confused, because milk is not a big part of most like East Asian American diets. And like if we have any like dairy products, it's like ice cream, or it's something that's like yogurty, but it's still not the same kind of yogurt texture that is so common in America. And I remember being really confused with like how everyone was like drinking milk at school, because I still wasn't used to the taste, you know. I think I have like, I mean, it's very common, but having this like low degree of like lactose intolerance to an extent. I remember other foods that confused me were like, I was confused by salad dressing, and it's like, it's no offense to these foods, but it's more like I was getting used to this like new like experience. And there are just a lot of foods that I didn't quite understand. But I think though, growing up, I think that's things that would definitely hurt my feelings, because when I was like processing like milk or like cheese, I kind of kept it to myself. I think it really hurt my feelings when like kids at school would like make fun of like my packed lunches. But then, you know, because like, but then you think about like the richness of like authentic Cantonese cuisine. But then the irony of that is how when I got older, so maybe from college, let's say from the time of life when I was in college as like a older teen to like young adult, 20 something, that was around the time when I think people start to mature. And then like a lot of people will start asking you, oh, if we go to like New York together, could you take me to the best dim sum? If we go to this place together, can you show me what to order? And obviously if someone's your friend, you're going to like do that. But you think about this cultural phenomenon of like how food, such as in my case, Chinese foods, were made fun of at a young age for being like pungent or stinky or just different, you know? But then nowadays, you know, like food culture drives so much consumerism as well. Then all these people who haven't been exposed to that food, suddenly they want to go to the best dim sum or like noodle house, or they want to get the best like roasted pork. But it's like in many ways, it stems, no offense, but it does kind of stem from this fetish. It stems from this fetish of like, oh, this food, just like this culture has been like othered, but now like I want it. And I think that in, yeah, and I think that in poetry, I kind of like, I'm able to also use food kind of similar to like the color red, let's say, as like this like reclaiming of power, because yes, food does matter. Like it's not just about like sustenance or like staying healthy or staying alive, but it matters because China is like such a complex place. My family is from Hong Kong, and whenever I go to Hong Kong, like my parents actually like educate me on food, not just how to cook it, but also they educate me on these like big gaps of knowledge of like my own culture. And I think that I kind of take the space of my poems to explain that to people. And I also do think, you know, metaphors between food and sex, there's a lot of them, but you could also just like use food as this like pleasurable experience. Cause I think like so often there's room for all kinds of poetry. And I think that food is something that regardless of like what foods someone likes or how picky of an eater they are or what culture they come from or what culture they're trying to like fit into, food is something that unites us all. Like we can all be happy sharing a meal.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
What would your ideal table setting be? Oh,
you mean like if I creating like a menu and stuff? Oh, that's fun.
Maybe not a menu, but like for your friends or whoever.
Yeah, definitely.
So or yourself, that's all, just by yourself.
Yeah, so that's an amazing question. Because my next book that I've been working on is actually like set up like a menu. The table of contents is actually like set up like a menu. But I think that my default would always be like dim sum, because dim sum is a very communal experience. Mm-hmm. And it's also just like really great because there's definitely something for everyone in that. I would say too, I would probably, if I could choose, and it's funny because I was just talking to Tatum about this last night. One time during one of the trips, the family trips to Hong Kong, my family took me to a very like authentic, and that's funny to say authentic because everything in Hong Kong would be authentic, but a very like, but an extreme, like this was like authentic to like the infinite, let's say, like, you know, if like a regular some place is authentic, this place was like authentic to like the extreme, okay? And they took me to this like authentic dim sum place with like all kinds of like they had like the standard stuff such as like the shumai or like the pork buns, you know, but they also had like stuff that is like really like rare to find and kind of like old fashioned in a way. And I thought that was like really cool because I also think about how I would go to dim sum with my grandparents in Hong Kong, not just for convenience, but dim sum is kind of this like, interestingly and beautifully, I usually don't say this, but it's actually a very like beautifully traditional thing that people do. So oftentimes if you are in Hong Kong, especially Kowloon, and it's like, especially before the afternoon, you will see a lot of like much older people sitting there with like their lifelong friends, because that's what, it's just this very, I guess, beautiful generational thing.
Yeah. So communal and
gorgeous. Yeah.
That you can see that and share that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And it's just like really like easy that way. Cause it's like communal. So it's easy to order extra. And it's also just easy because like, I love the fact that so often, you know, most Asian style meals are served very communal or family style. You can have like a little bit of everything.
That's beautiful. That's the experience of reading Babe. It's,
oh, thank you.
Just this very generous, generous book. And I felt seen reading it, and I felt honored to be able to see these parts of Babe and the textures, the colors. It's just, it's really eye-opening. It's just filled with wonder, and it was a pleasure to design. It was a pleasure, to lay out, specifically talking about the poems. They look really nice on the page. I mean, I'm not going to do my own horn, but like
they look amazing on the page.
It was really like the sonnets fit in a way that I was really surprised was so easy.
Yeah.
Like I thought I'd have more trouble like getting it to work, but it just and the way that you or that I like would read through it, it just your words flow with such ease.
Thank you.
So thank you for that opportunity too. A pleasure.
I can't thank you enough. I just like feel like it's just been such a wonderful time so far with you, Zoe, and with like Patty and Law and Diet. I remember like one of my favorite memories is when we got to meet. It was was it? Yeah, it was AWP Portland, right? Yeah, Portland. We had that like really like big venue, so it was like really nice to get to see like a good number of like the Diode authors, and, you know. And I think that we have such a beautiful, vibrant, diverse, important community. And the sonnets look perfect on the page too, because like the triple sonnet is like really hard to format because it's got the third, so you want to like make sure that it's not like cut off, you know. That's always like the thing, but it works so delicately and so perfectly. And as we talked about earlier, it's like accessible, it's also pleasing to the eye. And I think that a high number of readers are able to like access the information on the page. And I really can't thank you enough. I'm just like really touched with like being able to also see your process today. And I was so touched when we were like working on the book and we got to like do the reading, and just makes me so happy. So thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to talk about all this. I'd love to talk to you again about color just in general. Like,
yes.
I have other color stories if you're interested.
We need to talk about that. I would love that so much. And I am hoping, you know, that once it is like safe to travel, you know, I look forward to like the next AWP or the next conference we do as a press, so we can connect more.
Yeah, definitely. I look forward to that too. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Zoe. Yeah. This was such a highlight.
Definitely. So speaking of just logistics before we hang up.
I will
download Otter and see what it does. Hopefully it'll work out. And do you want to just see, like, maybe I'll share the Google Doc or something.
Yeah.
We can both look at. And I also don't know what is like appropriate for interviews in terms of editing at this point. I realized earlier that I forgot to include the name of the designer for this book, because the cover artist is different than the designer.
Than the art. So I was thinking too, because I really loved like all the images that you showed. So I think that like when we send it to Palette, and I think they're like really chill and flexible. So I think that first, if you wouldn't mind downloading Otter and seeing how it transcribes, and then throughout this week, I can also look at it. And because I know many times the transcriptions can get kind of funky, so I can remember what we said and I can change what they said, right? And I don't think that like we should like edit the interview much. I think that it's like very, very like perfect and natural. But I would say that it would be great to include all the things that you brought up today. So maybe we can also send Palette like the images that you would like to share, especially like with the bears, the cherries, the queer. Yeah, all that stuff. And then I know that like the Liberace and the Las Vegas sign, I know that we don't own those images, but I think that we can like gesture to that. So we can give Palette a list, because it's such a, because all of this stuff was such a big part of our conversations in there. And then regarding like the books that were referenced, such as The Randall Man and such as The Ocean Vuong, I would also say that I would just, I can just like email Palette and say, hey, we talked about these books. Can you put like a caption or something? Yeah. Or a link to, or it better not like link to the book. So
yeah, probably.
I think the conversation is much more, it just, the images enhanced it so much. So I think that it would just be really amazing for the interview, since it's all about design and cover and community, to be able to see all these images that we referenced today.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. I've got them here, so I can include them in that too. So awesome. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And I'll be on my email. I'm sorry that I was kind of late in responding back the first time, because we just started the semester, but I'm getting the hang of it. So I'd be happy to keep looking.
It's fine. I had to take some family time. So I've just, the past couple of weeks, I've just been crazy, and you can see behind me, it's like just a mess. Everything is just taking extra long. And I've been saying it's the pandemic, but I mean, it's just the new normal.
Exactly.
I've been taking a while too.
And I'm happy to like look at all the stuff this week, and so like I'm really like looking forward to sending it to Palette. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks.
Yeah. Have a good evening. Yeah, you too.
Yeah. It's closer to noon there. Okay.
See you. Yeah. We'll talk soon.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. We'll talk soon. Yeah. Bye.
Bye.